Good evening. I'm Patty Kostelic, your host for Home Fires Radio Show, and it is a wonderful evening out there. In the studio this evening with me, I have some people, and we're going to talk about hunting. I have a couple of hunters and an expert from Fish and Game biologist Kathy Harms. I have Todd Smith, a local bow hunter, and Forrest Bowles, who's president of the local retriever club and presumably hunts with his dogs as well as showing them. We're going to talk about that. I got this great idea because it's the middle of hunting season in interior Alaska, and I thought, well, a lot of people probably don't know too much about it, because I certainly didn't know anything about hunting until I moved to Alaska and made friends with a lot of people who, it turns out, one of their passions was hunting. I had never even fired a gun till I got to Alaska, and I was telling my guests that now I fire a gun once a year in a gravel pit just to make sure I could hit the target. That's the extent of it. But I have had my kitchen turned into a butcher shop for a moose, and I am now aware that it's a lot of work. And so in some ways, I've had a little bit of education, but I'm going to be the sort of innocent in the field here this evening. And I assume, because the weather is so spectacular, that one, no one's out there. But if you are, hopefully you're outside listening to your radios and maybe can't call. But if you are, by any chance, in the house, we'd love to have your hunting stories, your questions, whatever you'd like to add to the program, by calling 474-5044. When I got this idea about doing a hunting show in the middle of hunting season, it just didn't occur to me that everybody would be hunting. I don't know why, but it didn't. And so I was on the phone before I reached Kathy, finding out that everybody that Sam had suggested was gone.
And it's pretty much true.
It turns out that Kathy discovered the same thing.
Well, actually, I'm in touch with a lot of different sportsmen's groups in Fairbanks, and the bow hunters and the retriever were really helpful and furnished us with two experts from the clubs to talk with us. As far as finding someone who just liked to go moose hunting and didn't necessarily belong to a group, I don't know of any moose hunter right now that I could have found that isn't out hunting right now. So I would have liked to have had someone like that here, but they're all busy.
Since I listen to KUAC, that's why I hear your show Interior Outdoors, and that's why I'm aware that it's hunting season. Sam isn't hunting this year. We still have moose. I want to tell you, a moose is a very big animal. You need a family of eight, and you need to eat a lot of moose before you can use a moose up. Plus, it's a lot of work. So It seems to me that once you've managed to shoot one, you'd think twice about shooting one again.
I think my favorite quote about hunting moose is that the fun stops when you pull the trigger, and then it's all work from then on.
Actually, we have a couple of friends that go out hunting, and I'm going to get to this a little later. But it's a wonderful way to get out in the outdoors. And when they come back and they haven't shot something, you say, did you get anything? And they say no. They actually aren't too disappointed. They had the wonderful experience of being out there. Now, not everybody feels that way, clearly.
Uh-huh.
But
I know several people that consider a very successful hunting trip one where there's nothing to clean.
So. And the weather is so great that anyone who is out this weekend is having a wonderful time. If they're in the central.
They must be.
What I want to ask you is, what can you hunt legally right now? I mean, when I say it's hunting season, what's out there to hunt?
Well, it depends pretty much on exactly where you are.
Okay.
Right around the Fairbanks area, most interior moose seasons open on the 1st of September, except for an area around the village of Minto. That's called the Minto Management Area, and it opens on the 17th of September. But for the most part, moose seasons do open on the 1st. Most of them tend to close on different dates, so anyone who is interested in hunting moose should really check the regulation books for where they're going and when the dates close.
I guess we get that right out of the way. In case someone is thinking about going hunting, we'll just say right now, ignorance of the hunting laws in the interior of Alaska is no excuse, and so if you're seriously considering doing some hunting, you need to go down to Fish and Game, get the regulations?
You can pick up the regulations from either at Fish and Game, from any of the licensed vendors. Most of the sporting goods stores in Fairbanks are licensed vendors. And you can pick up regulations there. You can get them from the trooper's office. There's a lot of different places you can get them. And like you said, ignorance really isn't a very good excuse when the troopers are there asking you questions. So
we don't have a trooper in the studio because they're all out.
They're on patrol.
They're
right,
all out patrolling. So
that's true.
If you're listening to us on some kind of remote radio that you've, for some bizarre reason, taken on your hunting trip with you, watch out, because they're out there.
Yeah. Now, as far as other animals that can be hunted right now, caribou seasons, there are some caribou seasons that are open. Two important caribou seasons, fairly close, or at least accessible from Fairbanks, are closed right now. And one of those is the Delta caribou herd, which is in the area south of Fairbanks, between the Nenana River and the Delta River and north of the Alaska Range, south of Fairbanks. That area has been closed for hunting caribou. That was to be a 30-day or a 300-caribou season, whichever came first. And the caribou limit, the quota, was reached within 5 days. So it was closed after a week.
That's in Delta.
Well, it's not in Delta. It's called the Delta caribou herd. But it's actually one of the easiest places to get to it is near Healy, or Ferry, around in there.
I heard news stories that they closed the Taylor because of the snows.
The 40-mile caribou herd lives over along the Taylor Highway. And that's a real interesting story. The Delta herd was closed because we had set a quota. We met that quota and we closed the herd. And the 40-mile herd, we didn't have an official quota. We had an unofficial quota. We knew how many animals we wanted taken out of that particular area. And for the last 10 years, the caribou have been very standard, following a pattern as far as where they migrate and when. And we like to have the season open so that hunters can hunt, but we didn't want a tremendously high harvest out of the herd. And this year, for the first time in 10 years, the caribou decided to park themselves right on the Taylor Highway, right during when we had planned to have hunting season
very
open.
Convenient.
Convenient, yes, on some regards, but the chance, the possibility of an overharvest was really great, and we already had a harvest of the herd, and we didn't want to risk an overharvest, so the 40-mile caribou herd has been closed along the Taylor Highway, and there are certain areas that are still open in that herd, but you would be best to ask either the Fish and Wildlife Troopers or Fish and Game if you're going to the Taylor Highway. Most access right off the Taylor is closed. However, there are areas where the 40-mile herd is still available.
They got some real snow in that area.
They've been getting a lot of snow down, and I guess the Macomb caribou had quite a bit of snow around that. I haven't heard too much, but that's near Delta.
It was in the news earlier this week, and that's all I know about it, what I heard on the news, that there were a couple of hunters that were late coming in, and I guess they'd been spotted from the air, and they were fine. But
mm-hmm. Yeah, it could be an early winter in certain parts. That's for sure. So anyway, there are some caribou herds that are still open south of Toke on its Game Management Unit 13. There's some caribou seasons that are open there. The Yannert River drainage is still open for hunting caribou. And, of course, the Arctic caribou herds are still open. That's pretty much north of the Yukon River. And the Western Arctic herd has a very liberal bag limit this season. Hunters may take 5 caribou a day there.
Oh, goodness. However, herd numbers are really up?
Oh, the herd is in the neighborhood, close to 200,000 animals. Not quite, probably 150,000 in there.
But you'd have to fly out there.
Yeah.
To access that.
I can't think of too many other ways to get there right now. But, yes, the limit, like I said, is very liberal. It's 5 caribou a day. However, if you don't live in that neck of the woods and you plan to hunt there, you can only bring 5 animals south of the Yukon River with you. So you're limited if you don't live there by how many you can bring home with you.
Right, because you can't eat a caribou for dinner.
Not a whole one.
Not a whole one.
No.
Okay, I'm going to ask Todd, how long have you been hunting? Long time? Is this
15 years.
15 years. You must have started when you were
10.
10. Mm-hmm. Did you start bow hunting at the beginning or mm-hmm. did from the very beginning?
Yep. I started shooting a bow when I was 8, and I started hunting when I was 10.
Do you have a family that's interested in bow hunting, or
no.
How did you happen to choose that?
I don't know. It's just always been a passion of mine. It's been an obsession ever since I can remember.
It's a method of hunting that's becoming more increasingly popular. Is that true? I hear more about it.
It's growing every day.
What are the advantages of being a bow hunter?
Well, that might be personal. Around here, I guess, you can hunt close to Fairbanks for moose, and you can hunt in the pipeline corridor up north. There are special seasons for bow hunters a lot of times, and that's an advantage if you happen to hunt with a rifle also. But other than that, the advantage to archery is the personal satisfaction, I think.
The method itself.
Mm-hmm.
I might throw in a comment here. I know that from a lot of hunters I've talked to, you have to, correct me if I'm wrong, Todd, but you have to really be a very alert hunter to get close enough to a large game animal to be able to take it with a bow and arrow. So it requires actually a lot of experience.
Stealth.
And one of the things you mentioned is a concern of mine right now. Because there are areas around the Fairbanks area that are limited to bow hunting, we've had a real rise in the number of people who have bought archery equipment. But just because you own a bow and arrow doesn't mean you're a bow hunter.
That's exactly true. You have to train with your equipment. You have to become familiar with your equipment. And, well, there's some education that's available and will be more available in the future. The local clubs, Golden North Bow Hunters Association and the Toklat Bow Hunters, they'll be offering some education to the public because we're very concerned with this. It's not good for people to just go out and buy their new equipment and not be familiar with it and go out and try to take on big game. It is very difficult. You have to stalk within, say, 50 yards is a long shot.
Oh,
big game has
close.
Been taken longer distances with the bow and arrow, but it's difficult. And the closer you can get, the better it is.
That gives you a special relationship to the animals.
Yes, it does. It's very rewarding. I mean, you can have so many experiences with them, and like you were talking about coming home empty-handed, but you can have close, right next to them, intimate relations with these animals and not take them and be completely satisfied.
Uh-huh.
That's the best part of bow hunting.
I was going to say, growing up, my father grew up on a farm in Western Canada, and I think he did quite a bit of hunting when he was a kid, but by the time he had the family. We were living in very civilized Midwestern college towns, and there just wasn't a lot of hunting. And he was always an avid fisherman, but he didn't do any hunting after he had us. And so I think I had some very provincial provincial ideas about what hunting was, sort of growing up in the 60s. And I don't know, we were flower children. You don't want to hurt anything. And half the people I knew became vegetarians. And you know, But since I've been up here, it's real clear to me that some of the people that I know who are avid hunters are also the most knowledgeable about the natural environment that we live in, that they're really...
I think they've had a lot more closer experiences with it. I'm not saying that people who aren't hunters haven't experienced wild animals and been in their habitat and so
mm-hmm.
forth. However, I do think that hunters have learned a tremendous amount. Otherwise, they're not hunters.
Mm-hmm.
If they don't know enough about the animals to be able to stalk them and to be able to get close to where the animal lives, they're not successful.
And it takes you into some really wild terrain, for example, sheep hunting.
Oh, my. I have this running joke with the sheep project at Fish and Game. I go out and help them with different surveys and collaring operations and so forth. And my complaint is that the only reason I ever go out with the sheep project is to see if my sweat glands still work. It's amazing. Those animals just dance up the sides of mountains that I'm struggling with terribly. It's amazing.
I know, flying over the brooks, you see those sheep, they're just absolutely on the ridges, and you must have to come up the back side to... Todd, do you ever go sheep hunting with bow?
Yeah, I just got back.
How was your hunt?
It was wonderful. Absolutely wonderful.
For people who haven't been hunting, how long were you gone?
5 days.
Okay, and what happened? You flew? You
no.
had someone fly you?
No, we drove and then parked off the Hall Road and walked in.
Okay.
Walked in somewhere between 5 and 8 miles.
Five and 8 miles?
Yeah.
Over what kind of terrain? How did it...
Well, it's the foothills and the bases of the mountains. There's a lot of... Well, we followed the creek bed in.
Uh-huh. Do you have to cross the creek a lot, or...?
We try not to cross it any more than we have to. I took a little tumble while I was up there and got a little wet.
That's always fun when you're out.
Yeah, it was wonderful, wonderful. Especially when you're loaded down with your pack and everything.
Uh-huh. How would you describe the walking? Easy, hard, medium?
Well, the walking itself isn't bad if you take your time. It just depends on how you push yourself. And you take your time, and when you get tired, stop and rest. You can handle it. Anybody can handle it.
A lot of up and down?
No, not too bad.
How was the weather?
Beautiful. It was beautiful.
Like this?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Didn't rain on us at all.
That's unusual.
And it had snowed previously.
Okay, so you go with... How much weight do you have to carry on your back to have everything you need?
We try to go as light as we can. Probably total with the archery equipment and everything, somewhere around 40 pounds.
Okay, well, that's one advantage. You don't have to have all that heavy ammunition and our bows.
Or an 8-pound rifle or anything.
Right. So you cut down a little bit that way.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you walked in for a day or so, and then at that point you were in sheep country.
Oh, well, yeah, we saw sheep all the way in.
All the way in.
Mm-hmm.
And you're looking for full curl.
Looking for legal rams.
What's a legal ram?
Up there, 7/8 curl.
7/8 curl.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that is a curl that goes 7/8 of the...
Of 360 degrees.
Of 360 degrees for people who aren't familiar with this terminology. Mm-hmm. And anyway, that's the kind of ram you want.
You always want
a Boone and Crockett or what?
Well, Pope and Young for archers, but you want as big as you can get. But then...
Okay, how often does one see a ram with a 7/8 curl?
It depends upon where you are. We saw one that was questionable. We had to get close to make sure whether it was or not.
And when you got there?
I believe it was. It's hard to tell. It really is. For me, I don't know. Other people can tell me by looking at them, that's a legal ram. I have to sit and study it.
I think most people do have to sit and study it. It's 7/8 is it's a real toughie to be 100% sure about. And by the way, most of Unit 20 now, down around Tok, Delta, and areas like that, is now full curl, which means that the outside of the horn has to go through a complete circle when you look at the ram from the side. And you really have to know what you're doing, and you also really have to look at the animal.
How old is an animal by the time it has a full curl?
It depends on where the animal lives. Different populations of sheep have different horn configurations, but for the most part, adult rams, when they're full curl, it's in the neighborhood of 8 years. It could be anywhere from 7 to 9.
And what is their life expectancy?
I'm not 100% sure, but I'm pretty sure that the 12-year-old ram, I think, is pretty old. Usually when rams hit breeding age, their natural mortality drastically increases. It really increases. And this is a little bit off the topic of hunting, but... that's one of the reasons that 20A went full curl this year. It's an experiment to see if we can hold off harvest until the natural mortality factor is already set in, rather than causing the natural mortality of younger rams to increase because they have to breed.
Right.
So anyway, it's around anywhere from 7 to 9 year old when a ram reaches full curl. And the reason I jumped into this conversation was to urge people who are going sheep hunting to really look. Study that ram, like Todd said. Some people are good at identifying it, but most people aren't. You really have to look to make sure you know whether or not it's 7/8 or full curl.
We had a friend who just came back from the Brooks and was on a sheep hunt, and he said he followed this ram for most of a day and a half, and he got there, and he said it was a miniature. It was just like, it was a really tiny one. He said it was very odd that it was, in fact, a full curl, but it was just a...
Some areas don't have, you know, the sheep grow horns, and they're old, and they're adults, and they're certainly healthy, but they're just not massive heads. So your definition, if you're looking for a trophy, the definition of a trophy is different for different animal populations. And some areas are managed more for trophies, and some areas aren't.
So I gather from your description, Todd, that you didn't bring a sheep back.
No. No.
How many sheep do you think, I mean, roughly, did you see during your 5 days out there?
About 200.
So you got a lot of time to scramble around with the sheep?
Well, we did, but 200 sheep and 200 rams are two different things.
Right.
We didn't see 200 rams.
Right.
When we were back in there, we probably saw 10 to 15 rams, and they were all small.
Uh-huh.
Just the one was, we figure he was legal.
Uh-huh. But you didn't get, you didn't manage to get close enough?
Mm-hmm. Oh, but I pulled the stalk on him, which
was... What's that mean?
Well, I tried to get close enough to shoot him.
Okay.
And that was the first time for me, as a matter of fact, for sheep. And it was a very interesting stalk. It was completely different than stalking anything else I've ever done before. And it's very challenging. You're working with something that can see anything that moves for miles around. I'm not sure if I'm correct, but I think they can see with about a 7-power eyesight. So like when you're looking through binoculars...
That are seven times.
I mean, I've been told that, yeah.
Right.
I don't know if that's true or not.
You've got me there, I'm not sure.
But anyway, you've got this animal that lives there, just like with any other animal. It's like his house, his home. He knows everything. You're coming in there and you've never been there before, or maybe you hunt there once in a while, and you're trying to match wits with this animal and to get within, say, 50, 40, 30 yards, as close as you can get. And it's very challenging. And as a matter of fact, I had went all the way up and around on this ram, and it was starting to get dark, which made things even mm-hmm. trickier. He had seen me, so I had to go even higher. And then when I came down and around as low as I could get, when he came out, because he heard me, he heard rocks tumbling. A lot of times they will ignore that, but anyway, he came out to see what was going on. And there I was, 100 yards away. He vacated the premises quickly.
Too quickly for you.
Yeah.
For your taste at that point.
Yeah, and then it was too dark to continue. Mm-hmm.
And so then, if you'd had more time, you could have started all over again, or by
if
then
he had
was...
bedded back down.
They're very wily by then, of course.
Yeah.
And they can travel a lot faster. It's just incredible.
They travel very quickly.
It's amazing being in some of the country that I've been in, which has a lot of muskeg and so on, and you're just sort of falling off of these tusks and you're in hip waders, and it just takes you a long time to go half a mile, and it's not easy going. And that sort of double jointedness of the caribou and moose, they just sort of float up to the top of the ridges effortlessly, or apparently effortlessly.
It sure looks that way. Let's put it that way.
They're designed for the country, and clearly a person in hip waders is not.
I think it would be tough to match grace with any wild animal in their habitat.
But that in fact, is one of the things that you have to approach doing when you're bow hunting, I gather. You can't be making a lot of noise, and you certainly have to be in their terrain. It's treeless up at the level that they are at. For our audience that hasn't been up there to see what kind of habitat they live in, and they are above the tree line. Mm-hmm. At least from the air, it looks very barren, and it'd be pretty easy to shake some gravel and rocks loose and make a loud noise,
yes,
and scare them. And there's not very much cover.
It's a lot of rocks.
A lot of rocks.
Hide behind the rocks. Climb behind the ridges.
Mm-hmm. So, at any rate, it's fairly arduous work. It's not a romp. And then, if you're successful, you have to carry the whole thing back on your back.
Yep.
The whole thing.
Well,
and how?
Basically,
and they weigh.
You can bone me.
60, 70 pounds.
Oh no!
Oh no!
Goodness!
Oh gosh!
Oh,
no! A big ram is in the, well, what, 180?
180.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. A good sized ram, I guess, would
for
be at least.
For the whole thing. Maybe more.
Yeah.
But that sounds like a good guess.
Yeah.
Okay. And you could carry that in one trip or
no.
two or
no,
three.
Two. But see, you can bone the meat. You can leave a lot of the bones behind. You don't have to take the hoofs. You don't really have to save the hide or anything.
So that's another skill you have to have is learning to do good field dressing.
Oh, yeah. Unless you want to ruin your meat. And you don't want to do that because you've worked hard for that sheep meat. And that sheep meat is the best wild meat I've ever had.
Yes.
I've heard several people say that.
I had the privilege of eating some backstrap a couple of years ago, and that is absolutely wonderful meat. Mm-hmm. In fact, my experience with game meat in Alaska, since I know people who, in fact, do very good field dressing and really take care of their meat is that it's incredibly delicious. Mm-hmm. Just excellent, but it has to be treated properly.
Oh, and sure.
Where did you learn how to do field dressing?
From childhood, really, starting with deers in Indiana, all the way up to now, with friends of mine that have been successful and being in on successful hunts.
So it's very much a sort of an apprenticeship experience where you go out with someone who's a more experienced hunter and...
If you're fortunate. Uh-huh. Either that or you learn by mistake and you have bad-tasting meat.
If people are interested in learning how to do it and they don't have an experienced friend, a good source of information about field dressing and taking care of meat would be the Cooperative Extension Service. And they have brochures about field dressing and how to take care of meat so that you don't make as many mistakes and you do have good quality meat.
I've heard people get into really long and very esoteric discussions about the proper way to dress things out, and obviously the experts have a variety of opinions on what's the best way. Someone does this and someone does that, and I couldn't even begin to repeat it because I haven't had to do it. But there's also supplies that you can take, dressing bags and so on that you buy.
Sure, game bags to protect the meat from getting dirt and sticks and things like that on it.
And now weather, which seems calm and wonderful when you're maybe out in it hunting, can, if it's too warm, can all of a sudden be a problem keeping that meat if you're too far out.
Or keeping it dry, or keeping in certain seasons in certain places, making sure insects aren't around. keeping it away from other animals who might want to take it away from you.
All right. Once you've got it, it doesn't necessarily mean that other creatures out there aren't interested as well.
Especially with moose hunting, it's real common for bears to visit hunting camps and snatch away quarters of meat and run off with them.
And heartbreaking when you've got it all dressed out and you've taken it.
I think probably quite a few of the bears hunted in the interior are incidental to other animals. Mm-hmm. You know, a bear visits your camp after you've already taken something else, and so that's...
You'd prefer not to shoot the bear, but you have to, otherwise you won't have a moose.
Well, it's not always that way. A lot of people enjoy hunting bear and just plan on hunting for both moose and bear at the same time. But when you do take a game animal and you've got the meat prepared, you certainly don't want to ignore it or just let it. Because other animals will make good food of it. And
What animals have you, in fact, successfully shot with a bow? The list is too long.
Not myself personally. That's why I made it a very good point to let you know that even if you come home unsuccessful, you're not unsuccessful.
Right.
Because I've had numerous run-ins, numerous occasions to watch game and see what's going on. But as a matter of fact, this year was my first successful hunt for a big game animal, which might sound bad after hunting for 15 years, but most of the early years were small game anyway.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the small game, that I could say probably I couldn't count.
Right.
But anyway, I was successful on a caribou hunt this year, and that was just fantastic. Finally.
Uh-huh. A real thrill because it's something that's not easy to do, and you've been out there to know that even if you've got your skills together, I assume that you're a very good, shot?
Well, I'm very familiar with my equipment anyway.
Right, right. And you've had a lot of experience doing that.
If the type of people who do want to jump into bow hunting, they go out and buy a bow and arrow, and they practice a little bit and they take off, the chances of wounding an animal and not killing it and not completing the hunt and just causing some animal to wander off wounded is very great. It's very, very great. So usually a successful bow hunter like Todd will spend years stalking, learning how to get close enough, and so forth. And the chances of wounding an animal and not having a successful hunt that way are much greater for people who don't practice and who don't spend years
learning.
Well,
we urge people that are going to shoot with a bow and arrow to come and contact us. They can call me anytime. Mm-hmm. I can be reached at work all the time, and that number is 452-3936. Because that can happen, but it can happen with anything. You pick up a rifle and go out and you haven't practiced with it, you haven't sighted it in, then you also can have wounded game.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't want to have archers having a bad reputation at all, because it's not necessary. As a matter of fact, and depending upon placement, it is not impossible or, you know, extremely difficult for a cut to heal.
Uh-huh.
A cut can heal.
Whereas a...
And when you take a bullet, I'm not condemning mm-hmm. hunting with mm-hmm. a rifle
no,
at all. But I'm just making sure people understand that with a broadhead, sometimes if you don't successfully kill the animal, the wound will heal.
Uh-huh.
And it's not necessarily going to wander off somewhere in pain and die.
What mm-hmm. kind of a defense against bears is a bow and arrow?
Well, it's done real well for me so far.
You're the proof of the pudding.
Yeah.
You're here.
I've got complete faith in the equipment. Guides, people that are very, very familiar with bears and rifles and bows and arrows have seen bears that have dropped just as quickly.
Uh-huh.
You can drop an animal in its tracks. My caribou did not take one step. It dropped in its tracks, and you can do that with a, well, not every time, but you
practice.
Can do it to bears.
But the experience of being out in nature, especially in Alaska, which is very uncivilized nature. I mean, it's not at all the same as Yellowstone Park, mm-hmm. for example, to put things in perspective. It's a very humbling experience for me when I've been out on canoe trips. You really feel like you're part of the world. You have some concept of what kind of a planet we're on and so on. And that must be especially true doing bow hunting because it's such
exactly.
a long, long tradition that is really the way early man...
Well, it also seems to me to be an equalizer. You're more of a part of the nature. A bear can come and whoop you real easy.
Mm-hmm.
You've got a bow and arrows. And you're not that much superior, however you want to look at it, with a rifle, especially a high-powered rifle. You can almost kill anything that moves very quickly and easily. And you to me, I don't feel like part of the flow with a rifle.
Uh-huh.
I feel like the aggressor or something like that. I feel like I'm out there, and
right.
anything I see is within my power,
uh-huh.
whereas with the bow, it's a challenge. It's
uh-huh.
it's not a game, but it's matching wits, and
uh-huh.
it's very difficult to relate, but it's a wonderful feeling.
Uh-huh.
One other thing I wanted to mention about the bow hunters is, correct me if I'm wrong, Todd, is it the Alaskan bow hunters that have the reward program?
ABA.
ABA,
yes.
The Alaska
Bowhunters Association.
Have had a standing reward for information about anyone who is improperly hunting. They're very good at policing their own ranks.
Yeah.
And anybody who is interested in getting into bow hunting, I would suggest strongly that they contact a bow hunting organization.
Oh, yes. Please do.
Good. Well, you do you bow hunt birds?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You can?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Our other guest is, I assume, since you use retrievers, Forrest Bowles is president of the Retrievers Club, the local Retrievers Club.
Yes.
Here. Is there only one Retrievers Club?
Yeah, in Fairbanks. In the state of Alaska, there's two. There's another one in Anchorage. There's a group of people in Juneau that would like to get a Retriever Club started, but they're a very small club, and they're working hard, but they really don't have enough people to get one started. But I expect sometime in the future they will.
Retrievers are dogs that go and get the birds after you've shot them.
That's what they are. They're non-slip retrievers. They sit at your side and wait for you to shoot the bird, and then they go in and retrieve it. Is in contrast to a Brittany or one of the pointing breeds that they find the bird for you to shoot, and then they do also, some of them do retrieve the bird
mm-hmm.
from there.
I grew up, I was telling you before the show started, I grew up next door to someone who was very involved with field trial work and hunting and using dogs, but he used Brittany's, and they, in fact, went out in the fields and they would point. They'd find coveys of...
Now, you can use a retriever in the same manner. A retriever will work quite well on pheasants and other type of upland game, but they do not point the bird. They go ahead and flush it, and they will hunt it, hunt the bird up for you. It just depends on what type of hunting and where you live and what you want to do with it. We're fortunate in the aspect that you can do both type of hunting in Alaska for the waterfowl, and you can hunt grouse also, and then you get to use your dog in both ways.
Uh-huh. What breed of dog do you have?
I have two Labrador retrievers. They're both black, a male and a female.
They're beautiful dogs.
Yes, they are.
I know from watching John, I mean, he not only spent a lot of time with his dogs all the time, but he also sent them to special schools from time to time. And it can be a very time-consuming job to train dogs.
I spend probably from the 1st of April till the 1st of September training, oh, pretty close to 2 hours every night. That'd be a good average. And that's 7 days a week. You can sometimes give me on a Saturday and I'll train much more. And then some night I might not train at all, but basically 2 hours a night every night is probably a pretty good guess. And then after the 1st of September, then I do a lot of hunting, a lot of waterfowl hunting. And some aspects of it is training, and most of it's just, man, I've trained this dog all summer long, I got to get out and do some more hunting.
Well, we have a Springer, and our dog he looks like a classic Springer, but he does not spring, and he has absolutely no interest whatsoever in any other kind of wild animal. Certainly birds, rabbits can run right by him in our front yard, and he looks the other way. I mean, he's just made it very clear he's not interested in retrieving. How do you know if you have a dog, if you have a pup, that could be a retriever?
Well, I think most retrievers have the basic instinct in them. What you need to do is try and buy a dog that is out of from a reputable kennel, or you happen to know the parents and the grandparents of the dog, and they've been trained and they have the qualities you're looking for. And then the most important thing is to start training the dog at a young age and make that basic early training a lot of fun for it. And if say up to about a year old, you've just made the training a lot of fun, the dog's natural abilities, and well, it just becomes the main thing in his life to do, and then usually you can go from there real well.
Okay, I know you can't teach us how to train a dog over the radio in the next 15 minutes, but what are the kinds of things you do with a pup when you first start?
Well, I could give you a kind of example. Let's just take my young dog, belongs to my wife and myself, and we brought her home the first night, and we just took her out in the yard, picked her, got something soft and real pliable, something that she could pick up. It was real light, and it turned out to be just a handyman glove, and we just started throwing it for her, and a natural instinct in this dog was to go pick it up. Now, their natural instinct is not really to bring it back.
Right.
They're to take it somewhere else and, you know.
Chew it up.
Yeah, that's right. And so we just, you run away, clapping your hands, just getting real excited. And as a dog runs back to you, it's retrieving. It doesn't really realize it yet. But as it goes by you, comes to you, then you take it from it, tell it, man, what a good dog. And you do that. And you just, for the first little bit, that's about all you want to do. You just want to really build up the dog's drive. You just want it to think that there's nothing else in the world it wants to do but retrieve. So once you got that, then you start to steady the dog. When a dog is a finished retriever, you want the dog to sit and stay while the birds are being shot. So that's what I mean by steadying. You want the dog to stay at heel as the bird hits the ground. So you start to teach them that. For the first year of age, at the end of a year of age, you want the dog to just sit, stay, and retrieve everything it can see fall. And from after the dog's about a year of age, then you want to start to teach it to take your directions, teach it to handle, to retrieve birds that it didn't see fall, but he will have confidence in you and your ability to go out and look for the bird. You will give it a whistle blast and it'll sit down, and then you give it hand signals and it'll go wherever you want it to go. You can take a good field trial trained dog and you can put that dog on a dime as far out as 300 yards. And that's what you want to do. That's what everybody's working for. By the time your dog, if you want to be competitive, you want the dog to do that by the time it's about 2 years old.
Uh-huh.
Unfortunately, my dog's 2 years old right now, and she doesn't do that.
But, what does she do?
Well, she's working at it. We've got it for, she'll take a few basic hand signals, and she'll go out and look for the blind retrieve. But I expect by the time she's three or four that I'll be able to run competitively in a license field trials in the state of Alaska.
We have a friend who had a dog. I gather it was a fairly good retriever, but hated to go out into the cold water. So you practically have to throw the dog out of the boat. Once he was wet, he was okay, but he really, I remember them telling a story, they're pointing, and the dog, Buck, is just looking the absolute opposite directions, like refusing to see the hand signals, because if he doesn't see them, then he won't have to get wet.
Well, that's where you want to start real young and make it a lot of fun. If you do all that, do all your basic groundwork good when they're real young, then all that stuff as a dog gets older just comes along a lot easier. Basically, Labs and Chesapeakes and Golden Retrievers and all the retriever breeds, they love the water. A lot of times you have a hard time getting the dog out of the water. And a lot of times the cold water doesn't bother them. They start breaking ice and things like that, then I have to admit they really don't like it. But the fact that they're retrieving and that's their main job in life, that overcomes the fact that there's a little bit of cold water.
Well, I don't think this was considered a positive trait in this dog. Which came first for you, the hunting or the interest in training dogs? I mean, are you hunting because you like to work with your dogs, or are you...
Well, I started out hunting. I wanted to hunt. And then you get this duck that you shot, and it's out in the middle of this pond, and you're looking at it, and you're saying, now how in the world do I get that? And you suddenly realize how bad you need a dog. And you don't want to swim after that. When I was younger, I threw a lot of rocks, and you'd throw the rocks, it'd work the duck back in towards shore, and boy, you'd waste a lot of hunting time just trying to get that one duck to float back into shore. There's other times when you'd shoot one, and it'd fall out in the middle of just a tall grassy area, just miserable stuff to walk in, and you realize again how bad you need a dog. A dog will find that bird in just a matter of no time. This last weekend while I was hunting, I again realized how much a retriever has helped save birds that would otherwise be lost. It helps to conserve game. We found birds that other people had shot and were not able to pick up. We just happened to be walking through an area that somebody else had been hunting in, and our dog come across a wounded bird. Well, you know, if the other person may have had a dog, he would have found that bird.
Uh-huh. I was going to mention, Forrest, I don't know if you can do it in a real quick time or not, but can you describe the difference between a real good field trial dog and a good hunting dog? Are they one and the same?
Well, they're not really one and the same. There's a saying that if you train train your dog to be a field trial dog, that he will be a better hunter. But that is not always the case. You can have a field trial dog. In a field trial, you're imposing your will on the dog. You're telling the dog what you want it to do, and it's a very strict, disciplined arena.
I was going to say, could we back up a little bit, and for those people who don't know what field trials are, just give a sort of basic thing, what happens at a field trial?
A field trial originally began as a place where all the duck hunters got together with their dogs and said, my dog's better than yours, and here we're going to all get together and we're going to prove it. Field trials evolved into a much bigger... some of the things are that in a field trial are not the type of thing you do in an actual
field situation.
Yeah. You get the distances, like 300 yards. I don't know how many people will have an average retrieve in their hunting situation of 300 yards. How many people are skilled enough shots to shoot three birds out of the one flock, and that is what they would call in a field trial a triple retrieve. And a dog has to remember where all three birds land, retrieve each one, and bring it back to you. Basically, in a hunting situation, you shoot one bird out of a flock or maybe two birds out of a flock. I'm not fortunate enough to be a good enough shot to shoot three out of a
isn't like one of those Marx Brothers movies where you shoot the gun and a whole bunch of birds just sort of like raining birds.
Rare situation in the real world.
To go back to the difference, the distances, the amount of birds, and the precise lines that you need to have in a field trial situation, your dog will take the most direct path to the bird and come back in the most direct path. And if that means he has to jump over logs or go through water or where it would be easier for the dog rather to run down the bank and come out, jump in the water, get the bird, jump back out on the bank and come back, he can make that retrieve in half the time and probably stay a lot warmer doing it. But in a field trial, you just want absolute precise things.
I see. So it's real prescribed what is good retrieving in a field trial situation. And in a hunting situation, you just want the dog to get the bird and get
it bird,
back in the boat.
Get the bird, bring it back to you.
Or where,
and that's all you ask for. If you got a, in a hunting situation, if you've got a dog that, if you can take it to the general area of where the bird fell and tell the dog to hunt that bird up, if you'll go ahead and look for it, you'll save a lot of birds that you would normally lose. One thing I would like to add, though, in a hunting situation and the field trials, it's just ideal if your dog will handle. I don't know how many birds that I shot or my friend shot this last weekend that, well, the dog's just never had a chance of seeing hit the ground. Your buddy would be shooting a bird over here, and you have another bird falling over on the right-hand side, and the dog never saw it, so you had to handle the dog to the bird. A lot of times you're hunting in a deep cover that's up to your waist, and the dog comes up to your knee, so he really can't see anything.
Handling the dog means that you give the dog the signals of where the bird has fallen, whether the dog saw it or not, and
that's
he knows
correct.
From your directions, your hand movements, where it is.
That's right. And in order for a dog to do that, it takes a lot of time, a lot of training, but by the time you get them out in the field, you see where it all pays off.
Right, because some people might think if their dog's willing to just go after birds, that if you took the dog out and you have a dog that's sort of a natural retriever, that it would see the bird and it would just go get it naturally, but it doesn't work that way.
An untrained dog is more of a liability in a duck blind than, say, a trained dog. I would much rather hunt with a dog that's been trained 3 months.
So you would not suggest to people to take their ball freak dog out to the hunting grounds?
Most of the time I wouldn't. If the dog will find the bird, if he's got the idea in his head that he's looking for birds, maybe it'll help. But if you've got a dog that's never seen a bird and you've never took the dog hunting, you've never done any type of training, I'd say leave the dog at home and go with somebody that has a trained retriever.
I've talked to a lot of different hunters who... really, they've been duck hunting all their lives, and once they've gotten a dog that's well-trained and everything else, that's the reason they continue hunting. They just like working the dog and seeing how well it makes a really incredible partnership.
It's, like I say, now I get to the point, I've shot enough birds already this year where I give them away to my friends, uh-huh. But now I'll sit at home in the evening, like I said, I'll say, man, I've trained this dog all summer, I've got to go out again. You know.
Well, it's the experience of going out and being there with the dog and watching that dog work and see the training pay off.
There's a real satisfaction to see that. You get a bird that you know you could not find, and a dog finds it. And you just say, wow, this is where it's all at. I'm glad that I did this all summer.
Well, I'm going to get to you, Kathy, and we're going to talk about this day that's coming up. But one of the things, I think a real payoff if you get involved with fishing, if you get involved with hunting, and I'm not doing either, but I do go canoeing, is it really gets you, I've got frogs in my throat all night here, it really gets you outside and enjoying this beautiful country that we have. It's a real good motivating factor to get out and enjoy it.
Oh, you bet.
If we have some people who have their appetite whetted and they want to find out about more interior hunting and fishing, you have a thing coming up.
Do I have a deal for them? I have just the marvelous day for them. For the last 5 years, on National Hunting and Fishing Day, which is the third Saturday in September, the Department of Fish and Game has had an open house, and we've celebrated National Hunting and Fishing Day at the same time. And that particular day, it was recognized by Congress many years ago, as a day to think about what contributions to wildlife conservation that sportsmen have made over the years. A lot of people don't realize that the sale of hunting licenses, that money is earmarked directly for wildlife conservation. And also the taxes on arms and munitions and sporting, you know, guns, things like that.
Duck stamps goes toward wildlife
management and conservation. And so anyway, this day was set aside. We've been celebrating it in the fall for the last 5 years, and we're going to do it again this year on September 22nd, which is a Saturday coming up in 2 weeks. And both of the groups that both Todd and Forrest belong to are going to be at National Hunting and Fishing Day. And it's really a great opportunity to talk with people who have similar interests to you. If you have a retriever puppy and you want to learn how to train it, the Retriever Club will be there. They'll be running their own dogs. In fact, a couple of years ago, they started doing something which I think is fantastic.
they've let the public run their dogs and give them instructions on how to send their dogs out after dummies to retrieve.
You mean if you've got a dog and the dog's well-trained, it doesn't have to be you giving the signals?
You yourself could come out to the National Hunting and Fishing Day, and one of our club members will have a dog there, and somebody will throw a training dummy out in the field, and you'll be able to run the dog. The dog is that well-trained that you'll be able to do it. It doesn't really matter who's running the dog.
Well, actually, that sounds more appealing than trying to shoot a bow and arrow. I was telling Todd that I tried that once, and I got the inside of my forearm just absolutely massacred.
No, the bow hunter should be there, too. In previous years, we've had targets set up, and they let the public shoot bows and arrows and learn how to do
don't
it.
Don't do it. Don't do it.
Now, Patty.
It's painful.
If you learn it right. If you know how to do it properly.
Somebody should have taught you first.
That's the whole point.
I know.
The bow hunters will be there. They'll be able to give points on how to do it right so you won't hurt your arm. You really owe it to yourself to come out there and learn how to do it right.
I really shied away from that after that. It is an amazingly powerful instrument. I think I was just in awe. It's nothing like the little bent twig with a string that we used to play with those little things with those suction cups, you know, those toys that they had.
You bet.
It's not like that at all.
Well, the bow hunters will be there. The Retriever Club will be there. We've also invited the Tanana Valley Sportsmen's Association Rifle and Pistol Club. They're going to have a pellet range set up with targets and pellet guns so people can shoot those. The interior trail riders are going to be there, and they're going to have two horses packed up to go on a hunting trip so people can see how to pack on horseback. The falconers, the Alaska falconers, will be there with their hunting birds.
That's an amazing sport.
A couple of different times in the last 3 years, they have done falconry demonstrations during the day where they go over to Creamer's Field and actually have the birds fly. We've invited the Chitna Dipnetters, the Alaska Trappers Association, the Midnight Sun Moose Hiders and Muzzle Loaders have been there every year for the past 5 years. They let people shoot muzzle-loading rifles with no bullets, of course, and you get to see their colorful costumes. They're great. They just really dress up for the day, and they have all sorts of antique rifles that people get to see and shoot, and pistols. And we have Tanana Valley Sportsmen's Association is invited, the Sportsmen's Council and Wildlife Federation of Alaska, the National Rifle Association has a display. Plus, that's National Hunting and Fishing Day. Plus, the Department of Fish and Game's open house is going on. And we have demonstrations and displays of everything that the Department of Fish and Game does. All of our research projects have demonstrations or displays. We have demonstrations of the game capture techniques, how we catch animals to put radio collars on them and so forth, radio tracking. We're going to have 15-minute talks by biologists about different subjects. Wolf control will be discussed. People can come and ask questions about it if they want to learn more about it.
It's a real controversial topic here in the interior.
You bet. If people want to know more about it, this is the place to come. Also, we'll have balloons for the kids. We'll have refreshments to give away. We're going to have door prizes. Wildlife artist Randall Compton has donated an original painting to be given away on this very day, and you don't have to buy anything. Show up, sign up, and have your name drawn.
Actually, it sounds very interesting for people who, in fact, are not interested in becoming hunters themselves. It sounds like a great place to go and really find out about it.
Or if people aren't interested in hunting and they're just interested in wildlife and management and research and so forth, we've got two new things that are going to happen at this year's Hunting and Fishing Day. And while one is not new, we did it last year. It's called the Outdoor Equipment Swap. Anybody who wants to swap something that they can hand carry in that's not a gun, any sort of camping or hunting equipment, bring it along, swap it with someone else. The other one is called the Fish and Game Discovery Hunt. It's kind of like a scavenger hunt for kids, but they have to go around to different displays and learn something from each display and come back and possibly win a prize.
Sounds like an exciting thing. You're going to be out there with your bows?
Well,
or somebody.
I don't know. I'll be working on Saturday.
We'll have members from the bow hunting club there, I'm sure.
That's why we were lucky enough to get Todd today, because he had to work. Otherwise, he would be out. What would you have been out there hunting today?
Moose.
Mm-hmm. In the interior.
Oh, yeah.
And why are you in town? Because we asked you to come.
Because all the other members of my club were out goose hunting, and that's where I'd be if we had not been called.
Are you going to go tomorrow?
I will be out tomorrow.
Where are you going?
A good duck hunter never tells anyone.
Oh,
it's like a blueberry picker, Peg.
Oh.
You never ask where a blueberry picker or a duck hunter or a moose hunter is going.
It's a secret. It's like a good mushroom patch. You have to find a good place. Is it all just superstition? I mean, isn't every place equally?
You have to be a pretty good friend to know where I'm going to go hunting.
So there are places, in fact, that you can go in the interior that are just one day away, that you can go out just for the day and then come back.
Oh, sure. There's lots of
places. You don't camp
places.
Out very often. Or
where are those?
We'll get him here. It's only the entire KUAC listening audience that will know. Actually, you could give us all a real good bum steer, and we could be going in the wrong direction, leaving your good place safe. You just try a lot of different lakes, and then find a place that ducks
into
land.
In the interior, pretty much any place there's water, you'll be able to find ducks. Just look around. If there's water, pretty soon you'll be able to find ducks. Just keep looking, you'll find them.
There are a lot that go through Fairbanks.
Yeah, obviously. You bet. And they're on the way south now.
And they are.
I want to throw in one more thing, Patty. Hunting is a solid recreation as well as a necessity in many cases in the interior. If people see something that's not right, I strongly, strongly urge them to contact the authorities. You can either call Fish and Game, which is where I work, during the week, or you can call the state troopers. The Fish and Wildlife troopers work around the clock and on weekends, and you can call them any time if you see something illegal. In fact, they have a special program called Wildlife Safeguard, and that is it's like Crime Stoppers, only it's just about wildlife. And if you see something illegal and you call, ask the operator for Zenith 3377, you can give all the information you have and stop a poacher or someone who's just doing illegal things, and you never even have to give your name, and you might get a reward. So hunters are a very respectable group for the most part. There are a few real slobs out there, and a few slobs can ruin a lot of good times for a lot of really respectable hunters. So if you see anything illegal, please help the troopers out.
Because, in fact, most of the hunters all of the hunters I know, in fact, have a tremendous respect for the wildlife that's out there. And they would.
You bet.
And I have heard stories of people going long, long distances tracking down game that they didn't bring down with the first shot, and taking that responsibility very keenly.
You bet.
You usually don't have to chase birds for a long distance.
Well,
they usually drop.
We've spent a lot of time looking for a bird. An old mallard's pretty tricky, and he'll get up in the weeds somewhere, and we have spent a lot of time, and I tell you, we have lost birds in the past, but it's not after we spent probably an hour looking for that, you know, and an hour's quite a long time when you're in the middle of a lot of good duck hunting.
So I, you know, that has been my experience. The stories that I've heard, the hunters really do have a lot of respect and go to great lengths to bring back that game. And
most of the hunters that are really, really respectable you never hear about, and yet a few real slobs can give hunting in general a bad name, and that's a real shame.
So let's get rid of them.
You bet. If you see a slob, if you see something illegal, if you see something that's really a shame, call anonymously to the Wildlife Safeguard number, or call the state troopers, or call Fish and Game. I would recommend calling the troopers before Fish and Game, because we work more office hours. They work more around the clock. And their number in Fairbanks is 452-2114. And the Wildlife Safeguard number is Zenith 3377. It's free, long distance. You don't get charged for it, and you can be anonymous, and you might get a reward.
Terrific. Well, it's absolutely beautiful weather. I hope this weather stays. It's just heart-stoppingly gorgeous out there.
I hope it's exactly like this on the 22nd of September for National Hunting and Fishing
Day. Not
like
last year.
Last year we had 35-mile-an-hour winds, about 34 degrees, snow. It was less than miserable. It was horrible.
But that would give you a realistic notion of what you're in for if you become a hunter.
That's true. But we have ordered much better weather for this year. I certainly hope it's delivered on time.
This is at the Fish and Game headquarters, which is on College Road right next to Creamer's Field.
Right next
to Creamer's
Field.
For people that don't know it, Creamer's being an old dairy in Fairbanks, and that's where you go and watch the birds migrating through Fairbanks. I've really enjoyed this evening's conversation. I hope everyone goes out and sees all the things to see on the 22nd. This has been Home Fires Radio Show. I'm Patty Kostelic, your host. The executive producer has been Carla Tanella. Ah, yes, and we're moving to Saturday morning. Our show was on Tuesday, now it's on Saturday night. In October, the beginning of October, we're moving to Saturday morning at 11. here on KUAC-FM, 11 on Saturday morning. So I hope you can make the switch with us. Have a good week. Enjoy this wonderful weather.